Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a monthly collaboration between WERU and the Maine Monitor, whose mission is, quote, to deliver fearless, independent, citizen-supported, nonpartisan journalism that informs Mainers about the issues impacting our state and inspires them, or us, to take action, close quote. I'm Amy Brown. Kate Koff, editor at the Maine Monitor, joins us this month to talk about her new series on marshes in Maine. Let's get started with talking about how this project came about and what first interested you in Maine's coastal marshes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Amy. It's a good question. And I'm just going to start by letting everybody know that my husband, Caleb Jackson, does work for Maine Coast Heritage Trust. He's not involved in marsh restoration, but just for full disclosure, he works for them. And they are one of the conservation organizations that works on this throughout the state. So they are mentioned in the pieces. But how did I get interested in this? So this project actually arose out of an entirely different series that I did a couple of years ago called Unstoppable Ocean. And for that one, we partnered with an aerial photographer, Alex McLean, to look at how 10 different coastal communities in Maine are dealing with sea level rise. And for those pieces, we were really focused primarily on infrastructure. You know, we wanted to know, like, how are people planning on dealing with things like, you know, their homes and sewage treatment plants and firehouses, like the really big stuff that, you know, when it goes down, it's very visible and it really affects our daily lives. So, but, you know, as I was driving through these places and kind of researching where the scientists expect the water levels to rise to in the coming decades, I realized that actually some of our most vulnerable places don't have much human infrastructure on them at all. But they're really at very real risk as sea levels rise. So, you know, I'll give you an example. I was driving around Southern Maine, which is where I grew up, reporting on these stories. And I drove past the Scarborough Marsh, the Audubon Center in Scarborough Marsh, which some of your listeners might be familiar with. It's off Pine Point Road in Scarborough. And so people have been down there. You probably know this place. It's like this pretty busy stretch of road. It's between West Scarborough and Pine Point Beach. If you're heading off to the beaches and Old Orchard and Pine Point, it's kind of the primary road you take to get there. And it's a pretty small, kind of unassuming building on right off the side of the road. It abuts a bend in the Nonsuch River. You can rent kayaks and canoes and head out into the marsh, which is something that I used to do as a kid. I have very fond memories of that. We went on a full moon tour one time when the tide was really high, which was very cool. The road and the building down there are basically surrounded by the marsh on either side. And as I was driving through, I thought to myself, well, I mean, if the water is going to come up and really affect this building, which I knew that it had, the building had flooded periodically over the years. They'd actually lost an entire parking lot to the marsh. They had a hole in the floor the last time I visited because of flooding. I thought, well, you know, what's actually going to happen to the marsh surface itself? You know, is it just going to be open ocean? Is it going to be mudflats? So, I mean, honestly, it made me pretty sad when I was thinking about it, because I have, you know, like I said, I grew up there. I have really fond memories of kind of walking and biking on the Eastern Trail through Scarborough Marsh. It's this pedestrian path that's built, you know, through the center of the marsh. I'd gone canoeing there. And I just thought, you know, wow, if this disappears, it's going to be a really dramatic change to the landscape of this place. So I finished up the Unstoppable Ocean project, and I kind of let the idea lie for a little while. I worked on other things. I had a baby that kept me busy. And then I think it was in February of last year. It was kind of a winter afternoon. I had nothing to do. It was a little bit slow. And I thought I would just make some phone calls to see if anyone could tell me what is going to happen to places like Scarborough Marsh and these other marshes that we see up and down the coast of Maine. And it didn't take very many phone calls, and it didn't take very long for me to learn that actually there are a lot of people around the state who've been thinking about this for quite a while, and they are trying to come up with solutions to keep places like Scarborough Marsh from becoming mudflats or open ocean. So I made those first few phone calls, and then I was off to the races, and I started visiting these marshes, and I just went from there.
Well, depending on where you live in Maine, there is more or less marshland. Obviously, it's a huge state, and so a lot of parts of Maine don't have marshland at all. How much do we have compared to other places in New England, and just overall, has that been measured, the amount of marshland in the state?
It has, and it's actually wild. I don't think of Maine as a very marshy place. I live in Bar Harbor. We're up here in Hancock County, and I think of it more as, we've got cliffs. We have this very rocky shoreline, but actually, we have a lot more wetland in Maine than anywhere else in New England. We have about 5 million acres of wetland in the state. We should be really clear that there are a lot of different kinds of wetland. So I'm sure we have many listeners who are experts in this and can probably talk quite a bit more detailed about it. But I'll just speak generally for a general audience. If we are talking in general terms, the big distinction is between coastal wetland and freshwater wetland. And for these stories, I wanted to focus just primarily on coastal wetlands, because obviously they really face the biggest threat at the moment from sea level rise. It's not to say that there really aren't threats to freshwater wetlands, but I was just particularly interested in coastal wetlands and how they might respond and in the face of rising seas. So, talking just about coastal wetlands, Maine has 5 million acres of wetland overall, but only about 157,000 or so acres of that are coastal. So that's about 4% or so of our total wetland area. It's really not very much. And that number actually includes beaches, it includes mud flats, it includes anything that's covered by the tides at some point during the year. So, like I said, for these pieces, we're focusing primarily on coastal marshes, which are, there are different kinds of coastal marshes, and there are different habitats within the marsh and different sort of zones. But generally, they're grasslands that are periodically flooded by the tides and that have soils that are saturated near the surface, at least during high tide. And they're like pretty special places. They're pretty unique. The plants and animals that are adapted to survive there are really unique as well. I mean, if you think about it kind of in terms of a human, like we can't survive drinking salt water, right? We are adapted to survive only drinking fresh water. So it's pretty amazing that you have these plants and animals that can do both and live in both of these spaces. And that's really like coastal marsh plants are adapted to survive in both salt and fresh water, and they can tolerate certain levels of salinity. So they're able and grow to grow in places where the tide covers them, which is pretty amazing. Salt marsh is also really great habitat for migratory species. There are a lot of migratory fish and birds, like sea wren brook trout and alewives and bass and smelts that will come in and out of the marshes at certain times of year. People may have heard about the salt marsh sparrow, which is an endangered species that builds its nest just above the high tide line. They actually time their nesting cycle to the lunar tides, which is pretty amazing. And they build these nests right above the high tide line, and they can tolerate a little bit of flooding. But what's happening now is that the nests are often being flooded for too long, and either the eggs get cold or they just float away altogether, and they're losing these babies. So that's just one example of a bird that really makes use of the salt marsh. But there are so many others that are adapted to thrive in this very unique habitat. I read one paper while I was from the University of New England while I was reporting this series that said that the salt marsh is actually per acre more productive than the most productive than most Midwestern farmland in terms of the food web it supports, which is pretty amazing. And I would say, salt marshes aren't just important habitat, they also perform a lot of functions that are really of interest to us as humans. They're really good at trapping pollutants. So for people who live at the edge of the salt marsh and there's stormwater runoff off your property, the salt marsh is really trapping things like pesticides and agricultural runoff and preventing that from, sometimes they bury it in the soil and they prevent it from going any further into the habitat. They're also great at storing carbon. Salt marshes are actually 10 times more effective at storing carbon than tropical forests, and they trap it for a lot longer. So in some cases, scientists think they might actually trap it for thousands of years, which is great on a, planet where we're really extremely concerned about how we're going to get rid of greenhouse gases. And they also, salt marshes are also really great at protecting us against flooding. So if you can kind of imagine two houses on the ocean, one of them has a salt marsh in front of it, and the other one has a parking lot. The one with the salt marsh is probably going to have a lot less damage during a severe storm than the one with the parking lot, because the marsh will absorb a lot of the force from the incoming waves and allow the water to kind of sink down through. Whereas the house that has the parking lot in front of it, there's nowhere for that water to go but into the house. So that was a very long-winded answer, but basically the takeaway is that there's a lot of reasons that we should care about marshes. They're important habitat, they're really good at storing carbon, and they help us protect against flooding are just a few of the ones that I think are, I really took away from reporting these stories.
Right. Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, a lot of what happened there was the bad effects was attributed to the loss of the wetlands around that area too. So
Yeah.
have people always recognized the importance of marshes and the wetlands or and protected them, or how have they been treated historically?
Yeah, that is a good question. And it was one of the most interesting things that I learned while I was reporting these stories. So humans have been living in and around coastal marshlands for thousands of years. As you might be aware, the indigenous people who live in what is now Maine and Massachusetts and New England would harvest a lot of sweet grass, which kind of grows in the transition zone between the marsh and the upland. They would harvest that from the upper edge to use in basket weaving or ceremonies. There's actually some interesting news on that front last week that the National Park Service would allow the Wabanaki to begin harvesting sweet grass from within the boundaries of Acadia National Park for the first time in more than a century. It's another story, but so just an interesting note. So, Indigenous people who have lived here for thousands of years would harvest things like sweet grass. They would hunt for food in the marsh, like fish and shellfish. But it wasn't it. It was really when the early settlers arrived was when we really started to see pretty dramatic changes in the way that the coastal marshes were used in New England. So a lot of the people who came were coming from places in Europe where they used marshes to grow hay for livestock. And a lot of them continued to do that when they arrived here. Salt marsh hay grows really quickly. It doesn't mold as easily as hay that's grown in a regular field, which makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because it's adapted to grow in water. And, maybe most importantly, you don't have to chop down trees and clear land to grow salt marsh hay, which is a pretty labor-intensive thing to do when you don't have, mechanized harvesters. So you can imagine it was a pretty attractive option for people who were trying to feed their cows and their horses. And they pretty quickly figured out that you could get a marsh to grow more hay if you changed the way that the water flowed by building berms and ditches and directing the water one way or another. So I talked to a researcher for this piece who said that, and this is somebody who's been working in salt marshes in New England for several decades now. And he said that there was no sizable coastal marsh anywhere in Maine or probably even New England that he could think of that did not have farming infrastructure on it, which is amazing because I would look out at these places before I started doing this work, and I thought, this is just what they've looked like for thousands of years. They seem like really natural places. But once I started walking out into them and I knew what to look for, I realized that I was walking in many cases on berms that were really straight or that had right angles, which is just not something that really occurs in nature, right? Unless you really know what to look for in these places, you may not notice it. It's pretty subtle, but it's just kind of a ridge here and there. And like I said, the right angles, that's a really telltale sign that you're walking on some farming infrastructure. And once these farmers started doing this, it really changes the fundamental nature of the marsh itself. Because in a salt marsh that hasn't been altered like that, the water flows in and out evenly, at high tide. And that really continuous flow of water is really important to ensuring that those plants stay healthy because they are adapted to thrive in certain levels of salinity. But once you get water pooling in certain places or being totally blocked from other areas, you're changing the level of salinity and the water level. And so you're changing the kind of plants and animals that can live there. And that's what happened as these farmers began building these dikes and things on the marsh surface. It also becomes this very destructive cycle because not only do you have pools where the plants die because there's, too much salt water for too long, but you also have oxidation in the sediment in the marsh surface, and it slowly kind of decomposes the peat and it actually causes the marsh to sink. And that's really a problem when you have sea levels rise because you have like a sinking marsh that's flooding more often. It prevents certain plants from growing and trapping sediment, which is what you need to build the marsh surface. And so it really just becomes this self-reinforcing cycle where it makes it harder and harder for the marsh to grow. And we can talk a little bit more about that later. But talking more about, thinking more about this farming infrastructure, I just had no idea that this was such a widespread practice. And it's not done anymore. There are very few people, if any, who still farm salt marsh hay, although I did talked to one person for this series who said he and his dad used to use it to cover their blueberry crops because it doesn't drop grass seeds and allow the weeds to grow. For the most part, though, no, nobody farms salt hay anymore, at least not in kind of at any scale. And our marshland is mostly protected from people doing that. But so that was sort of the early settlers used the marshes for farming. But in the There was kind of a shift in thinking in the 18 and 1900s as we started to industrialize. And people really began to view marshes more as kind of an impediment than an asset. And they saw them as places that bred disease because you would have pooling water from this ditch infrastructure where mosquitoes would breed and other insects would breed, and those carried diseases that were harmful to humans. So one of the actually the largest marsh alteration projects that I'm aware of in New England was something that began that grew out of the Great Depression as a way to keep down the mosquito population and put people who were unemployed to work. It was part of the Works Progress Administration, and it was a project in which the federal government actually paid people to dig trenches in marshes up and down the eastern seaboard in an effort to get rid of some of the standing water so that we wouldn't have as much mosquito breeding. So that mindset shift, and that big project by the federal government, I think really changed the way that we looked at marshes. And for decades, I would say, we really saw them as kind of not that useful. They were mucky and soggy and hard to build on. And so they were often dredged or ditched or filled in. We built houses on them and businesses, and they just weren't really seen as useful. I think the figure is that the United States has lost more than half of the wetlands that existed at the start of the Revolutionary War. And they're pretty hard places to get back. Especially now that we have all of this development that is along our coastline.
You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This is Amy Brown from WERU. I'm speaking with Kate Koff, editor at the Maine Monitor.
So which marshes did you look at for this series that you're doing?
Oh, this was, it was hard to choose. Because there are a lot of very interesting places that we could have profiled. But I really wanted to focus on spots that would give us a sense of the different pressures that are facing coastal marshes and the different responses from the communities that they're in. So the first marsh we chose was in Wells at the Wells Reserve in Laudholm, which abuts the Rachel Carson National Wildlife Refuge, for those who might be familiar. And this was a place that we chose because Wells is a place in Maine where I think sea level rise is extremely visible. You know, we've seen really dramatic flooding there in recent years. We actually saw at one point the entire marsh just completely underwater. I was not there myself, but for the storms this winter, we saw it just looked like open ocean. The grass was entirely covered. There's a section along this marsh where there's these things that scientists call ghost trees. It's a ghost forest. It's places where the trees have died as the salty water has come up and infiltrated their roots, and they can't, they're not adapted to survive in salt water, but they're still standing. So it's really this kind of eerie edge of the forest where they have no leaves and they actually look pretty white and kind of drained of color. Wells is also a place where researchers have been studying sea level rise and how it will affect the marsh for quite a long time. So more than a decade ago, they actually published a study that said that the reserve would be fully submerged by the end of the century, depending on the sea level rise scenario, which I just thought, when I was reading it before we had started reporting, I thought, that's a pretty intense finding that this place where you work and where you might be devoting your entire career could be underwater by the end of the century. So I thought, I thought that merited focusing on that. It's also a place where there's a lot of development. There are a lot of homes in and around the marsh. It was actually, Wells was one of the places we profiled for the Unstoppable Ocean series as well, because there's been a lot of damage to the infrastructure and in the area from storms over the years. And many of the homes are basically sitting in the marsh and surrounded by it. And I was really curious to know how people in those communities were thinking about this resource that was around them and whether or not they saw it as something that would be, that was kind of worthy of protection and would actually be helpful to them in the future and protecting their homes from flooding, or if they weren't thinking about it at all. So Wells was one of the places we looked at. The second place we looked at was Scarborough Marsh, which I've talked a little bit about. Scarborough Marsh is a really fascinating place. In a lot of ways, it's kind of a massive conservation success story. It's the largest contiguous salt marsh left in the state. It's about 3,200 acres. And it really is this vast, mostly uninterrupted habitat block in one of the state's fastest growing communities. It's got a huge variety of species in it. There are salt marsh sparrows that nest there. I have yet to see these sparrows, by the way. They're very secretive and hard to find. But it has salt marsh sparrows. There are great egrets. There are sticklebacks. There's minks and bats and harbor seals and plovers and red-winged blackbirds. It's just a really, really rich ecosystem. And, one of the most interesting things to me about the Scarborough Marsh is when the conservation groups set out to preserve it, they were pretty successful. They protected this marsh from development over the course of, the last 50 or 60 years or so. But what they didn't necessarily anticipate was that they would also need to protect a place for it to migrate to. And so now what is happening is they are really trying in earnest to identify spots where the marsh might be able to move and migrate. And, in some ways, I would say that they are successful in that work, but it's a it's a pretty tall order in a place where people really want to live because they're competing with developers and with property owners for this land, and housing prices and property prices in that part of the state are extremely expensive, and people want to live in this beautiful place. So it's a really it I think it exemplifies a lot of the challenges that we are going to see as we look for places for these marshes to move. So that was the second marsh we looked at. The third was Old Pond Salt Marsh up in Hancock, which in some ways is the opposite of Scarborough. It's not very big, and it also is not surrounded by development. It has a fair amount of room to migrate. So this one we chose for that reason, because we wanted to look at a marsh that actually has room to grow and see what was being done to restore it. So in this case, this marsh is the site of a pretty interesting restoration project that is being led by Maine Coast Heritage Trust. And they're working with a man named Jeff Wilson, who has been sort of fell into salt marsh restoration a couple of decades ago and is now one of the primary experts on it in New England. And one of the first things they did in this marsh was they actually went out and mapped all of the farming infrastructure. So I've seen this map. It's not like any map I had ever seen. It's got the satellite image of the marsh, and then it just has these kind of squiggly red and green and blue lines all over it that shows you where the farming infrastructure was. And when I say infrastructure, I'm using that word a little loosely because we're really just talking about like ditches and berms and that sort of thing. But when it's all mapped out like that, you can really see how intentional it was. And you can also see how it sort of happened successfully over the course of decades and decades, where, one person put in a berm here and then somebody else put in a berm here. And the result is that you have this marsh where water is pooling in places where it wouldn't normally pool. So what Maine Coast Heritage Trust is now doing is very slowly over the course of years, they are moving these berms and filling in these ditches and runnels, and they are shifting the way that the water flows in the marsh. So I saw this marsh in kind of in the middle, I would say, of the restoration project. It was a year after they had built a little mound for some of the nesting sparrows in the marsh. And there was actually, I went out with one of the stewards, Tati Bauer, and she was looking at the, she went out and she was so excited to see that some of the grass had actually taken hold. And it's so subtle. If she had not pointed it out to me, I would not have known it, but it's just a few inches above the highest annual tide, and it will allow a place for these sparrows to nest. So that's a really interesting project because it's actually showing us, if it's successful, what marsh restoration could look like on the coast of Maine. And then the fourth marsh that we profiled is up the coast in Addison. For those of you who don't know, Addison is a tiny, sleepy little town south of Columbia Falls, very beautiful coastal Maine town. And the marsh in Addison is cut off by a dike that has been there for more than a century, and it has these clapper gates underneath it that allow the tide to flow in but not out of the marsh. So that ha clapper gate has dramatically changed the amount of water, obviously, that can flow into the marsh. And we wanted to profile this marsh because I think there's a real debate now over what should be done with these clapper gates and whether or not they should be removed. And I think it really exemplifies some of the choices we're going to have to make as communities as sea levels rise. And, the debate is really centered around what is original, what does it mean to restore these places? I think, on one side, we have conservation groups who would really like to see the marsh restored to its more natural ecological state. They would like to see the fish runs restored, and they would like to see these clapper gates either removed or changed in such a way that the tide can flow more freely. And then on the other side, you have people who have lived there for generations. I spoke to one man whose family has been there for more than 80 years. And if these gates were removed, much of his land would be flooded. And, he said, I recognize the ecological value that would come with restoring the tidal flow to this marsh. But I also think that humans have been altering these places for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so he just felt like we needed to have a real discussion over what it means to restore a place. And so that's really a fascinating back and forth over some of these decisions that I think communities around up and down the coast of Maine are going to have to make over the course of the next, 10, 20, 30 years.
So, where is the state in all of this? Do they regulate the building? The person who you mentioned, there was one person who still may harvest some saltwater hay or grow saltwater hay on the wetlands. Do people, if they're going to build, have to have a permit? What are the rules around it? What is the state's involvement?
Yeah, we do. We have a lot more rules than we used to. So you can't just go in, go around filling in wetlands now, as people, anyone who's tried to build somewhere might be aware. The way we have done it for the last 20 or so years is the state now has an in-lieu fee compensation program. And the way it works is you do need to get a permit, and there are certain places where you just simply cannot build. But the way this program works is it basically allows you to fill in a certain percentage of the marsh or a marsh so long as you pay a fee. And the fee varies pretty widely. I looked at the records for this program going back to 2008. And the fees in that time period for filling in wetland range from about, 2 cents per square foot to $9 or $10 per square foot, not including the administrative fee. And the reason for the range is that the state has a pretty complicated ranking system to determine basically how valuable these wetlands are. And based on the ecological value, they will assign, a cost per square foot to a developer. So I think some of the largest impacts to wetlands that we've seen over the last 15, 20 years have come because of residential development. It varies throughout the state, but residential development and then actually transmission lines and energy infrastructure has been the second most impactful. So I think residential development accounted for about 56% of the fees paid to the in-lieu fee compensation program. And then the transmission lines were about 36 to 39%. So yeah, so we don't allow people to fill in wetlands willy-nilly. We do track it. That program doesn't capture all of the wetland impacts around the state. It's only projects above a certain size, but it captures most of them, about 95% or so. So the state is tracking pretty thoroughly where these wetlands are being impacted. And then the money that is paid as paid to the state as part of that program, that money is then taken and used to conserve land and wet conserve wetland out elsewhere. So, we have lost about 300 acres or so of wetland to development over the course of the program. It's either been filled in or it's been altered in some way, but we have also gained, wetland that's been conserved elsewhere. So it's a little bit of a trade-off, and that's what we've done in order to that's what the state has done in order to sort of make sure that we're not just filling in wetlands in the way that we used to.
You mentioned the houses in the Scarborough area that are built right near the marsh or even in the marsh. So that was relatively recent. I mean, the boom in Scarborough has been within the last 20, 25 years or so. They knew those were wetlands then. Do the builders just calculate that into the cost of their doing business there, the fee that they have to pay to the in-lieu fee program? And does the in-lieu fee program preserve saltwater marsh for saltwater marsh and inland wetlands for inland wetlands, or can they take money from saltwater marsh being damaged and use it to preserve something in, a wetland marsh area or a wetland freshwater area?
Yeah, it's not a one-to-one. So the as I understand it, the money goes into a pot and then it conservation organizations apply with a particular project in mind, and then they are awarded money, grant money from that pot of money for conservation of wetland elsewhere. So no, it's not like if you fill in, half an acre of saltwater marsh here, you have to preserve half an acre of saltwater marsh elsewhere. They have a pretty complicated system for how they determine how that money is doled out. And in terms of the developers, I mean, you're right. A lot of that development has happened in the last 15, 20, 25 years. And I think yes, I think the developers just build those fees in, and the calculation that's made is that it's, people really want those homes and they will pay a premium to live by the ocean. And I think, all of this really gets at one of why Maine's coastal wetlands are so at risk. And I think it might actually be helpful to talk briefly about how a salt marsh actually forms, because I think it's important when we're thinking about how they would respond to sea level rise. So I'll get a little in the weeds here, no pun intended, but they form through this process called sediment accretion, which is basically just a fancy word for when you have really fine sand and silt that gets brought in on the tides. It's trapped by plants that have taken root in like a sheltered area of the coastline, like a mud flat that's protected from the wind and waves. And they trap more and more sediment, and the surface of the marsh really starts to build up. Those plants die, they build, they fall down on the surface, they build it even more. The soil becomes firmer, it's more and even more protected against the wind and waves. And, as long as there's no houses or anything in the way, the salt marsh can kind of just keep growing. And it can keep building at a certain rate every year. So I think the research that I found during the reporting for this project was out of the University of New Hampshire, and it showed that over the past 4,000 years or so, salt marshes in New England have grown about 1 to 2 millimeters on average annually. And for a long time, like that was enough for them to keep up with sea level rise, and they had a place to go because we didn't have homes along the shoreline.
If you're just joining us, this is the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. Kate Koff, editor at the Maine Monitor, is talking about her latest series, which you can read at themainemonitor.org. I'm Amy Brown, and you're listening to WERU-FM.
What's happening now is that the sea levels are rising faster than our coastal marshes are building that sediment up. And so in some places they're basically drowning. And then the other problem that we have, which we talked a little bit about, like what's happening with Addison, is we've got these roads and infrastructure that are cutting off the tidal flow in these places. And so you have basically one side of the road, the side that's closest to the ocean. Maybe the marsh can build there, but then on the other side of the road, where it's blocked from bringing that sand and silt in, the marsh can't grow up at all. And so it's really not just these homes, it's not just our houses that are the issue. It's also even a road can really create a problem. I didn't write about this marsh, but there is a marsh in Machias that has a dike through it that's been restricting tidal flow for, to the upland century for, I mean, to the upland section for more than a century. And the side of the marsh that's close to the ocean is on, is on one level, and then the side of the marsh that is on the other side of the road, that section of the marsh is 3.5 feet lower than the marsh on the other side because it wasn't able to build up. So that really also just starts it at this elevation deficit. I mean, it's much harder to keep up with sea level rise if you're 3.5 feet down,
Is that the marsh? Is that the structure that was affected by the January storms that one of your reporters reported on, where they're looking at how to rebuild, or am I thinking of something else entirely down east? I know there was a structure that needed to be fixed, but it also needed to be upgraded when it was fixed, or else it would just happen again. And that was part of the issue, was trying to not just get money from FEMA or whoever to build it back, but to build it so it would survive the second time around.
This is a different one that I'm talking about, but you bring up a really good point, which is that we are now, I think faster than anybody expected, we're now having to make decisions on what things we are going to save and what is worth saving. I mean, I think we saw this in or we're seeing this right now with the debate over the seawall road on Mount Desert Island, which is where I live. They just reopened that road after several local construction companies kind of pitched in, and I think they actually did the work for free. But that road had been closed since, I believe, at least since March after these storms. And it's right on, for those who travel, it's a very beautiful road. It is right on the ocean, but it just keeps washing out. And so the Maine Department of Transportation had been holding a series of meetings over the last few months to figure out, is this something that's worth putting money into? And right now we have this temporary fix where these companies agreed to, rebuild this road, but it's really just, that is just an example, like all of this, of these choices that we are going to have to make, and where I think we're having to make them faster than anybody was expecting.
One of our listeners, and actually one of the station volunteers, has been sending articles about that effort to rebuild that, because I guess a lot of local contractors were involved, and now the town is cooking meals for the local contractors. It's become a very Maine potluck DIY kind of way of fixing your road. But fortunately, they have enough people with the skills to do that. And speaking of skills to fix things, how do they know how to fix the marsh structure to do reparations and bring them back to a healthy state? You mentioned that the land trust is doing that. How do people know how to do that?
I think what was interesting to me in reporting this is that there's actually a pretty vast network of people with a lot of knowledge at both the local, the state, and the federal level. And there is an increasing recognition of the important role that marshes play, not just, in the ecological world, but also in terms of protecting us from storms. And so there really is kind of a more robust effort to do this, to figure out how we preserve them. I would say that the first you can't fix a problem you can't measure. So the first thing that's often done is actually just measuring the issue. I talked a little bit about how this man, Jeff Wilson, is measuring and mapping the ditches and the digging and the farming infrastructure. So that mapping is a really important piece of the puzzle to understand where this actually was. Then you use those maps to figure out how you will move those ditches, because you can't just go in and knock them all down or move those berms. If you go in and just knock them all down, you're not really going to accomplish what you will want to accomplish, and you might make the problem worse. There's a great term that I love that I learned through this work, which was zombie ditches, where Jeff said you really want to avoid reanimating these zombie ditches. You don't want to dump something into this ditch and then make it bigger, or so you have to be pretty precise in where you are actually digging and moving things. So that's the first thing you need to actually map the problem. There is something called the Maine Salt Wash Monitoring Network, which is an effort that is it's a group of organizations, including the state, that are measuring the changes in the marsh surface elevation in relation to a benchmark to understand how, are these marshes keeping up with sea level rise. So that's an important piece of the puzzle to understand how the surface is shifting. I think there's also just really like an increasing recognition at the state and federal levels of the amount of money that's going to be needed for this, not just to do the actual work of restoring these places and to go in and, pay a contractor to move the ground around or bring out equipment or do whatever it is you need to do in that part, but that you will need money to preserve the upland and space for the marsh to migrate, because if you protect the marsh itself, but you don't give it anywhere to go, then you've only really bought yourself 15, 20 years at most. So there is money that is going into conservation and in that area, but there are a lot of people with deep knowledge of salt marshes, and I think a lot of those people are now putting their expertise to use in figuring out how we restore them and how they can be protected into the future.
Does seem like it's going to cost money, whatever is done. And you mentioned that the people that you spoke with, you heard over and over variations of their three choices. You can do nothing. You can adapt to the changing climate change and sea level rise and so forth, or retreat from it. And so I think you're mentioning different examples of different strategies with all of these different marshes, but you mentioned in one particular, you're going to be reporting in this series on a road being moved, a city, towns that are taking it seriously enough, and also happen to be very wealthy towns. So maybe that helps, that are going to be moving a road rather than having it be further disturbed.
Yeah, this is a fascinating example, and I think that this is maybe either the first or the most dramatic example that we have seen in Maine of what people call managed retreat. So like you mentioned, we kind of have three options. We can do nothing, we can adapt, or we can retreat. And retreat is really, obviously, in most cases, the least desirable option. It's very expensive to move infrastructure or to let it go, and you have to figure out different ways around it. But this example is really interesting. It's so Spurwink Marsh, which is down sort of between Scarborough and Cape Elizabeth. It's about 487 acres or so, and it has a road through it. It's about 1,400 feet of road, and it floods pretty frequently, as I understand it. It floods, basically during each high tide. But it saw really dramatic flooding, like most of the rest of the state did, in the storms in January. And it's also got a failing culvert underneath it. And it has, it's impairing the flow of sediment to the marsh. It's not allowing the tides to flow freely. So recently, the towns of Scarborough and Cape Elizabeth came together and they essentially said, we are going to abandon this road. It's not traveled that often, it's pretty lightly used. It's been there for 134 years, but it would cost a lot to fix it. I think the estimates were between $5.5 and $20 million, depending on what they decided to do. And so they made the difficult decision to let it go. And so I think that, like you mentioned, like that is an example of retreat, and it's one of the choices. It's the kind of choice we are going to have to make more and more often as we see these sea levels rise and claim this infrastructure from us.
As you worked on this series, were there any surprises for you? Did you find pretty much what you went into it expecting to find?
I think for me, I was shocked by the farming aspect of it. I think that Well, I would say also that it was a little more hopeful than I had imagined. I think when I was starting out, there's a map that the state has where you can map out different scenarios of sea level rise. It's an interactive map, and you can say, okay, what will the coast look like with 1.5 feet or 3.9 feet or 6 feet? And I was going in and playing with that map, and as I was playing with it and zooming in on places, it really looked like we were like it felt a little bit hopeless. Like, we're just going to lose these places. There's not a whole lot we can do about it. And then, I mean, in some cases, I think that will be true. There are estimates out from the University of Maine that we might lose between 30 and 60% of our coastal marshland by the end of the century. And, kind of depending on the sea level rise scenario and depending on how we manage this, I think there are other estimates that we might lose 40% of our dry beach area, which is obviously a very precious resource in Maine to begin with. So those are pretty depressing figures. But I was surprised at the amount of resilience that is out there and the network of people who are already working on this and really thinking critically about it. So I was surprised and hopeful about that. And the farming piece, I just had no idea that the marshes had been used in this way. And it also occurred to me as I was walking through them that it meant that I don't really know what a sort of true salt marsh looks like, because all of the salt marshes at sea, I've seen, it turns out, have these ditches on them that aren't natural, that humans have made. So it's just emblematic of like we really have altered so dramatically. We've so dramatically altered the landscape around us, even places that I thought were pretty untouched.
So these articles, this is a series of articles, are not out yet. When and where can people read them?
Well, they actually should be out by the time we run this. The first one should be
Oh,
out by the
okay.
time we run this. Okay. So the articles, we will be running them over the course of 5 weeks, starting on July 28th. We will start with an introduction that kind of gives an overview of everything, and then move into the pieces that focus on the particular marshes. So they will be out in the Portland Press Herald and the Sunday edition of the paper. They'll also be online at themainmonitor.org, and they will be online at the Portland Press Herald as well. So this is a series we've done in partnership with them. They have a wonderful photographer who went out and took some beautiful photographs for the pieces, and so they will be. They will, people can read them at on the Portland Press Herald or at mainmonitor.org or in the Sunday paper if you still get the Press Herald Sunday paper, which I hope you do.
While you're on the website, I definitely
Oh, now
recommend
you're
taking. You
sorry.
can't hear me?
No, you're good now.
Okay. While you're on the website, I definitely recommend checking for the Unstoppable Ocean series. Is that still posted? That was excellent work, Kate.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that is still up, and I agree that that provides a lot of context for these pieces and talks. Like I said, that series really focused more on infrastructure than it did on that. Yeah, that series really focused on infrastructure. So it's great context, great background for this series on marshes.
Okay, and the website is themainmonitor.org, right?
The website is themainmonitor.org.
Don't forget the, you
Yeah,
won't get
don't
there.
forget the. Sorry. Yeah.
And real quick, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to check in and see what y'all are planning to do for your coverage of the elections this fall.
Oh, there's an election happening? I have no idea.
I heard tell there might be.
Oh, well, this was, as a small, nonprofit, nonpartisan local newsroom, we really thought pretty hard about how we could help people understand what is going on at both the local level and the state level and the national level. And we've got both of the seats in the House of Representatives up on the ballot this year. We have one of the state Senate seats. We have all 151 state representative seats, 35 Senate seats on the ballot. We also have a bunch of county offices on the ballot, depending on the county. We've got judge of probate, register of probate, county treasurer, register of deeds, sheriff, and county commissioner. So there's a lot going on. We have decided to stay out of the horse race coverage of all of it. I think it just is not really aligned with our mission, which is really to focus on sort of enterprise and in-depth investigative reporting. So we have decided to focus our reporting primarily on the county races, which I think often get overlooked. Things like, you know, the county offices like that, you know, judge of probate, sheriff, county commissioner, things like that. So I think those races really don't get that a lot of attention, but they really have a big impact on our daily lives. And so we will be looking at those races. And we'll also be looking at the statewide ballot initiatives. We did quite a bit of reporting last year on the ballot initiatives. And I think, you know, the feedback we got from readers was that it was really helpful to explain what was going on in those races. And I think, so we'll focus on the county issues. We'll focus on these really hyper local races. But what we've also decided to do, you know, given how much misinformation and questions about the voting process have really kind of permeated the discussion over the last few years, we're going to devote a lot of our reporting to actually just explaining the election process itself. So I did an interview couple of months ago now with Maine Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, where we talked at length about how the election process actually works. I mean, we got really into detail on, like, where, you know, when are the ballots printed and what is the sort of chain of custody for them? Where do they go? You know, how are they tested? How do you make sure that they're going through the machines properly? I mean, so I think questions like that, we're going to try and answer a lot of those so that people can look at that information and feel confident about the security of the election. So, and so that they have the information that they need to participate. Yeah. So I think, you know, I would just also note, like, we are an independent, nonpartisan journalism organization. We don't take a position on any particular political party or policy. We don't endorse candidates. We're really, you know, at the heart of our mission, and our mission for our election coverage is really just to help people understand the electoral process and help them make informed decisions at the polls. And I would say, if anybody has any suggestions or very particular questions that they want answered about the election, please feel free to reach out to us. You can find all of our information. You can email me. I'm kate@themainmonitor.org, and you can reach out to any one of our reporters at any time. All of our information is up on the website.
Great. So watch themainmonitor.org for that reporting. Their reporting also is frequently carried in the other newspapers across the state, and maybe next month on the Maine Monitor Radio Hour.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks so much, Kate.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. It was nice to chat with you.
You too.
That was Kate Koff, editor at the Maine Monitor. Her new series on marshes in Maine is co-published with the Portland Press Herald and is part of the Pulitzer Center's nationwide Connected Coastlines reporting initiative. Part one is now available at themainemonitor.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Amy Brown. Join us on the first Thursday of every month from 4 to 5 p.m. here on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill.